Number 9A.
Well, I hope I can make it clear what I drive at, what I want to really put over. And that is not how to read the text per se. Everybody has learned English and can read, but how to interpret the text as it is given by the author. Now, here we have a text that is given in a structural way. So a structural text, or the meaning of a structural text, cannot be read really linearly. Now, if we find the structure of that text, it has also one more big advantage. Namely, it is much more easier to remember or to make one's own a text that is structured than a text that is written in a linear way. Why? Because a structured text can be reduced just to a few categories. And if one knows those few categories, then one can compute oneself really the meaning of the text. And that is what I want to try to do, so that in the future you can think about the structure of that text, and thereby, if we find the structure of it, and the structure is always a structure of the three categories of being, and therefore knowing those three categories of being, we are able really to put the past presentation of John's Gospel into the present, and can put it into the language of the Christian Science terminology, and can put it back or forward, so to say, into our lives. So that what John was trying to show, namely the structured way of understanding the one principle, the logos of the universe, is then something that is available to each one of us for our present day life. So it becomes, therefore, a translated sense from the biblical meaning to the present meaning. And if it is a structure of categories, then we can also enlarge always the subject, because a category is always so big that it allows many aspects, many facets of the category to be used. Well, this is theory, and we just have to go on and see that within a day, two or three, we can really see the simplicity of having a structural sense of a text. We have started out, to repeat it this morning, by seeing that the Gospel of John has a definite place value within the Bible, namely shows within the Gospels the place value of science in Christianity. Therefore, all the four Gospels are showing Christianity, but John is showing it from the point of view of science. Therefore, we must not forget that the main aspect, therefore, is a Christianity sense, which now is shown from the point of view of science, so to say, combining Christianity with science, just as Mrs. Eddy afterwards combined science with Christianity. In this science, we know that this science is a structure of the candlestick that has four parts. The first part is always showing first the elements of being, the factors of being, the building blocks of being. That's the numerals of infinity. Then it shows that these building blocks are not static building blocks, but that there is a calculus at work, a Christ calculus at work, that shows how these ideas operate within the calculus. Then when that operation goes on, we always see that this brings out a new Christianity, that brings out a spiritual Christianity, the spiritual dimension of Christianity, because it has only to do with the ideas of God, and so brings out that towards which our age is developing, towards the universe of spirit, a spiritual universe including spiritual men. Which then tells us, well, What is it that brought all that forth? What is it that made that whole development go forward? And so finally we have the fourth point, science, which says it is because in reality there is only one thing going on, namely principle, and its infinite idea. It's not the people universe, and it's not the universe that is run by people, but it's a universe that is run by the divine principle of being. If we have these four big aspects of the science order, then we can go further to another layer, namely to what John is introducing, that he introduces the absolute Christian science sense. Science in absolute Christian science is truth and love, as we know. It's introducing no more so much life is not introduced in absolute Christian science at this point, because there is no more necessity for showing that there is a creation going on, an impulsion going on, but that the universe of truth, the ideal of truth, is something that is established forever. Therefore, it's just truth itself, and that truth itself does not allow any error, which then, at the point of love in absolute Christian science, shows that that truth is always conserved by love, is always embraced and mothered and protected by love, so that nothing can interfere with that one truth that knows only itself. So we have seen that the introduction of truth and love in absolute Christian science is showing those two synonymous terms in a quite a differentiated way, so that truth does not just mean any aspect of truth in every one of those four parts, but that it is very specified. And we have seen that if we go now through absolute Christian science level, that we have seen that in the first part, the word truth is that which reveals. It's the revelation of truth, and that revelation is necessary at the beginning, or we cannot be aware of truth. In the second part, that truth then has another office. It shows that when something has been revealed to us, it translates itself to our understanding. So there we find suddenly that truth is that which translates the one big truth to the point of all truth, so that the one truth becomes now infinite truths, plural. So it gives that translation sense. Once that truth is seen as translating itself to every point of truth, then what has happened is that everywhere, at every point, only the true idea is manifested, which means that the outcome of that translation is that we have only a universe of ideas, of truths, and therefore no more a universe of error. So truth in Christianity shows how it resolves every belief in error. So that's the healing aspect of it. It's that aspect which shows that truth does not know any error and therefore reduces error to its native nothingness. Having reduced it to its native nothingness, then there is nothing left but the truth itself. And so in the fourth part, we are acquainted with that truth that says truth keeps the idea always intact. So that nothing can happen to the idea. Nothing could happen to Jesus before Pilate and before the high priest. This is truth. We can see that truth has always some kind of an office that it does away with a false belief. Again, I go quickly through them because we have to see that office of truth. Again, in the first part, it is revelation, truth reveals. It does away with the false belief that the Christ idea cannot be revealed to us, that we are not aware of it, just as John the Baptist was not aware of it for himself. So it shows that truth is that which shows that it does away with the sense that we cannot have a revelation. In the second part, we could see that truth translates itself to every point of experience, so that it does away with the belief that we think that truth is up there somewhere, but it doesn't touch us, that God doesn't look after us, or that God is not aware of us, that God is not aware of the idea. It actually does away with that sense that there is no divine message from God to man, that there is no translation from God to man. And in the third part, we have seen very clearly that truth does away with error, which is sin, sickness, death, and personal sense. Those four main aspects of belief, of sin with the adulterous woman, of sickness with the man born blind, with death, with Lazarus being resurrected, and then with personal sense, with the prince of the world that has nothing in us. So again, we can see it's always demonstrating, so to say, that truth somehow is that which does not allow the belief of error to arise, whatever the beliefs are. And in the last part, again, naturally, we have seen that truth maintains man, that nothing could happen in that universe, that no pilot, no high priest, no crucifixion, nothing could really prevent the plan of love. So we have here that sense, as I said, like Mrs. Eddy said, in Jesus saw in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal men appeared to mortals. In this perfect man, the Savior saw God's likeness, and therefore it corrected. And this correct view of man healed the sick. So you have here a very good summary of the tonality of truth in its office in Absolute Christian Science. Then we have seen that also love, from the standpoint of Absolute Christian Science, is always then shown after truth has been stated, then love is stated, and that corresponds as what we have seen in Mrs. Eddy's statement. Thus, Jesus taught that the kingdom of God is intact. It is intact. It does not need to be freed from error. It is universal, and that man is pure and holy. He does not need to be healed. So with that sense of love, we can go through those four parts. They are always nicely distinct in their shades and hues in it. And so we have seen in the Word, love had the office to say, I'm going to fulfill the promise of revelation. It's a sense of fulfillment that comes and says, I'm going to fulfill the promise that the Christ idea is a divine infinite calculus. I show you how it fulfills itself. Then in the second part of Christ, which comes to the human, love shows that it acts so that that calculus is universal, that it is applicable universally, that it is a spiritual calculus and not the material calculus, that it is a universal calculus that does not know neither gravitation nor space nor time nor matter. It's a universal calculus that he presents there, and that the world is yearning for it and says, we want that too. How can I do it also? And everybody has access to that calculus. That's love accepting really the calculus. Then we have that glorious sense in the third part of Christianity, where he presents through the speech at the Last Supper the standpoint of the glory of God, where he sees that all is one, that we are all one, there is only oneness of being and oneness in the one being, and that is the glory of it. There are no shadow enters there, no darkness enters there. It is just that one glory of love. And finally, in the fourth part, we see the glory of love that shows how the mission that was destined for Jesus, namely to overcome death, how that mission is being fulfilled, finds its consummation, and nothing could stop it. Could you see the or hear the spiritual tone of it? If we only go as far as this in our pondering work, we already have a very clear sense of what the Gospel of John is all about. Without having said anything about any verse in it, and without having taken any incidents of it, well, here and there I put one in so as to make it clear, but even that we can put into metaphysical terms, we may no more have to resurrect our body, we may not have to meet Nicodemus, we no more have to meet perhaps the woman of Samaria. All these stories are biblical stories, are biblical symbols that do no more apply to our life. But the scientific fact about it, the scientific categories that lie behind it, they apply to our life. They are eternal. The symbols are not eternal, but the facts behind the symbols, they are eternal. And therefore, if we can translate the symbols of the Bible, not only into metaphysical ideas, but much more than that, namely to translate these metaphysical ideas into their categories of being, we even reduce the text even further into just a few categories. Here we have just the four and the two. Up to this point, we have only had to take into consideration four things, where Christ, Christianity, and science, and two, that's not very, very much, four and two, namely truth and love. If you understand that, we can begin to calculate already in quite a definite way. Having shown how it runs through, we have got quite a tangible sense of what John wants to present to us, what's going on in the universe per se. Now, we can go one step further and take those four and those twos, those fours, each one in the two, that's eight, two times four, eight, and can try in some way to epitomize these combinations of the four and the two. And so we get eight epitomes that are so fundamental that even they would give us already a very clear sense of what really John is talking about. Now, those eight epitomes are at the bottom here of your chart, of your diagram. They are there, and they are underlined. So we are not going to read all the text that is there, but only what we will call the underlined epitome. You see that there are epitomes that are underlined, and then there are not underlined epitomes. Naturally, we start with part one, with the Word. So perhaps you just have this diagram in front of you, long side, so to say, and we read like the Hebrews from from bottom upward, not from top downward. Actually, they read from right to left. Sorry. but still, we can see that we have to get used to reading it from bottom up to the top. Now, what are epitomes? Epitomizing is an art by itself. It's not easy. You see, when I work with epitomes, and I like to work with epitomes because this is the most modern way of for text interpretation, to reduce a lot of text to just the pith of that text, and to find out what is really the pith of a long text is not always very easy. And even if we find out what is the pith of the text, it's then still more difficult to put that in as few words as possible. And I had to put it into as few words as possible because the printer would not have space enough to print a long epitome. So these epitomes are really just, the core of it, the nucleus of it, but they have the advantage that they are easily to be understood because they are simple. Now, what do we start now with part one? With part one, we try to epitomize to ourselves what we have seen, namely the part one, which is really life and soul, giving us the nature of the Christ idea, defining the Christ idea. And then we had from absolute Christian Science truth, we had the revelation. So if we put these two together, we can easily see that what it wants to show, that truth reveals what truth, absolute Christian Science reveals what really that which the first part wants to bring out, namely that the Christ idea is the Son of God, and that Son of God is depicted in the text as a fourfold calculus. So that's the identification of it. So the very first part, from the point of view of truth, you can combine it. Actually, if I would have been true to the text, to an exact text, then I would have had a long sentence to write. And that is not really what I want to do. So the very first thing is that we look at reality and see in that absolute reality there is something at work, namely truth that wants to reveal itself, that is constantly at the point of wanting to reveal itself. It does reveal itself in the type of Jesus as the Christ, not only as the Christ, because Christ is just a term again. We must explain that statement, that term, and the text explains it then through a fourfold calculus. It says that Christ is actually not just a person, is not something mystic, but is really a divine calculus, a fourfold calculus. We will see, you know that from last year, and we will come back then later on this week to it again, so that we can elaborate always a little bit more. But for the moment, this is enough to see that what we must realize is that the absolute truth, as the Word wants to reveal itself, and thus reveals itself. At the time of Jesus, it wanted to reveal itself as the Son of God. It wanted to bring out Christ has come. The Father has sent his Son. He has sent it. He is here. We must accept it. We must see that he has come. So it reveals that the Son of God has come and that Jesus was that Son of God. But that Son of God was not revealed as a man in John, but as a divine calculus. That's the great point of John, because he was a scientist, and so he wasn't interested in revealing really a man. He was interested in revealing a scientific system, a scientific calculus. That's the great thing. So that we can start out and say, well, in the whole universe there is something going on right now that the absolute truth is constantly wanting to reveal itself to everybody who listens and has an open mind, to reveal itself as a saving idea which takes the form of a divine infinite calculus, which takes the form of the science of Christian Science, we would say today. If you write it today, not in Jesus' time, you would see that it reveals really the science of Christian Science. So we have that statement that from which we can go out. Then we come to the standpoint of love, and see that love naturally gives to that standpoint of truth its final purpose. And so I try to epitomize it and say love fulfills in us. You see, in us, because the revelation of truth has come to us and has revealed to us what? That it is a divine calculus. And love is going on to show that calculus is operating and fulfills itself, so that the love is shown as the fulfillment of what is stated in truth. Yes, because you will see when we go take the end a little bit for the beginning, you will see that at that point where the subject changes to the standpoint of love, that Jesus practically didn't have to move any more a finger, that everything did happen without Jesus having to move a finger. He didn't, like the other Gospels say, that Jesus wandered around and fetched the disciples and said, come on, leave your net, come with me. No, it shows the very opposite. He says, here he stood, and the disciples looked at him, the disciples of John the Baptist looked at him and said, oh, I am going along with him. Can you see? It was quite a different attitude, because John could see that the consciousness of Jesus as the calculus of being would, at the point of love, attract all what was necessary for Jesus to fulfill his mission. Quite extraordinary. And it's naturally our life. It's not Jesus' life. It's our life. It's the facts of our life. It's what happens with our consciousness if we take that standpoint.